It is good to be together again. It is a sacred time, this, and a sacred place, this. It is a place for questions more profound than answers, vulnerability more powerful than strength, and a peace that can pass all understanding. It is a sacred time, this. Let us begin it together in song. Many ministers hastily rewrote their sermon for today. I did not. I preached on this war last September, and the events of the last 6 months have only strengthened everything I believed about it then, which I won't go into again today. But I did change the prayer. Spirit of life and love, Father, Mother, God, we are joined today in a moment of gratitude for the warmth of this beloved community, for the comfort of this sacred space, for the moment of peace and contemplation in which to appreciate the precious gifts of life. This moment of relative comfort sharpens our perception of an imperfect world. We are reminded of the many innocent people in the world who are suffering hunger, terror, violence, and loss. We pause to share our concern and care for the people of America and the people of Iraq. Here at home, our thoughts are with all soldiers on all sides of this warring, and with their families and their loved ones, both here and abroad. It is a brave commitment to be a soldier in any army, to be willing to risk your life when your country assures you that it is worth the risk. May we find it in ourselves today to work toward a better tomorrow. These are hard and bloody times, guided by imperfect leaders on all sides, prompted by a mix of motives, not all of which are proud. It is a deeply human moment, rising from the always present, always dangerous mixture of good and evil that reside in the human soul, in human institutions and governments. We have both good and bad spirits within and among us. Today we pray to the angels of our better nature. We seek strength from the still small voices of understanding rather than arrogance, generosity rather than greed, compassion rather than war. These are the voices, the angels, and the spirits we need now and in the trying times ahead of us. We need these insights and strengths as Americans, as people of faith, as citizens of the world, and as brothers and sisters to all people on earth who cry when their hearts break, who bleed when they're cut, and who, with us, hope and pray for a better tomorrow and a better world. Let us hope and pray, but not only hope and pray. Amen. I've never begun a sermon with this phrase. In a recent USA Today poll, people were asked what one question they would most like to ask God. The overwhelming response was that they wanted to know the purpose of their life. This says at least two things. One was that they didn't know the purpose of their life, and the other is that they hadn't found it out from God either. And the third was that there was apparently a hidden joke in there. Some of this is a measure of living in modern times. In ancient times, even medieval times, people felt that they had encounters with the gods regularly, all the time. They provided places for it to happen. In ancient Greece and Rome, they had shrines where there were statues of the gods and fires lit to them and temples you could go to be in their presence. People encountered the gods all the time. But today, about the only place people can still feel the overwhelming kind of power that was once associated with gods is when they fall in love and are connected either to Aphrodite, the older kind of love, or Eros, the adolescent kind. Last week I used a medieval myth of Parsifal's quest for the Holy Grail as an archetype of a man's struggle to grow up and grow whole, as a salvation story for men. I think that the archetypal salvation story for women is much older and much more complex. It's the very ancient, even prehistoric, Greek myth of Psyche and Eros. Parsifal's story was one of adventures and conquests. Psyche's story is one of relationships and unfoldings. Parsifal, like most men, had to grow up through experiences, adding brick to brick to brick to build a structure that could hold a full-grown man. Psyche, like most women, grows up through learning how to find and develop the seeds already inside of her. Psyche is the Greek word for soul. It's also the Greek word for butterfly, that beautiful thing that takes flight only after it's gone through a metamorphosis, hidden away in a cocoon. Eros was the adolescent god of love. Today we call him Cupid, and we picture him as a fat little baby floating around with a little baby bow and arrow. But the Greeks knew better. They knew he was a teenager. And Eros was depicted as a teenager flying around with his little golden bow and arrow. And the Greeks saw the falling in love kind of feelings also as adolescent. I want to move back and forth between real people and this old myth, as I did last week. Last week, I also talked about the labyrinth so I could have three balls to juggle. And this week, for my third ball to juggle, I'll be talking about a movie, one of the movies that's up for the Oscar for Best Picture tonight. The story of women growing up and growing whole is more complicated, and I think women are psychologically more complex than men. I'll confess at the start that while I felt pretty confident last week talking about the lives of men, every time I start to feel confident this morning, I hear this little feminine voice from somewhere that says, "Shut up, you fool." And so, my dear women, this is the best I can do. You see if it fits. The story begins in adolescence, as it did for Parsifal, too. Psyche is an adolescent girl, beautiful and mythic, and all those parts have to be there. She's the prettiest of the three girls in her family. She's really too pretty. Boys admire her. They may even worship her, but from a distance. She's more like an image of an adolescent kind of mythic beauty than she is like a real woman. Girls today are flooded with images of Psyche, images of that beautiful, mythic, often vacuous look that they're taught to emulate. Britney Spears, Christina Aguilera, J-Lo, or Liv Tyler in the Lord of the Rings movies, who has that amazing, beautiful, and absolutely mythic look about her. Teen and movie magazines carry their pictures, their stories, and young women know their stories the way they once knew the stories of the gods and goddesses. That's a measure of the times we live in, too. There's something about those images that's unreal and unfinished. They don't seem like grown women, or like wives or mothers or partners or parents. This is the age when girls play at grown-up roles they haven't grown into. These are girls known for prettiness or innocence, not depth or experience. That's the age of Psyche, a beautiful, naive, innocent, unfinished woman. And the old myth is about what she has to go through to grow up, to become whole. If she doesn't grow up, she may still be trying to play the role of Psyche in her 30s and 40s, when the role is really better known as that of an ingenue. In the myth, her untouchable beauty finally makes Aphrodite angry. So Aphrodite decrees that she shall be married to death, since she isn't playing a useful role among the living. Now this sounds fantastical, but it's more real than you'd think. I think the best way, the absolutely necessary way, to listen to Greek myths is to listen to them as absolutely natural and psychological stories about the real forces of nature and in our minds. You know, if you're raised in a monotheistic culture, then you could look at all these Greek gods and goddesses as aspects of one god. The Greeks saw them as separate. Either way, these stories make some of the powers of these different aspects become absolutely vivid. How do you get married to death? If a woman gets stuck in the Psyche role of being a dream woman, which means an adolescent male's dream woman, she stops before she grows up. And to enter into a marriage at that stage is to come in playing a pretty costumed role that can be the death of the human woman in her who hasn't developed. I'm talking about marriage and Psyche and Eros, but these relationships go regardless of the sexes involved. There are women who fall in love with men. There are women who fall in love with women. All the variations exist, but the dynamics seem to stay much the same. Now, there's a powerful character in the current movie, The Hours, that has much of this. It's Julianne Moore's character, Laura, who's this kind of a two-dimensional mythic image, and it's killing her. She even describes this picturesque life later on as death. But here's how the Greeks told the story more than 3,000 years ago. It's fantastic. Left on a mountain for death to take, Eros, the teenage son of Aphrodite, was sent to stick her with one of his golden arrows so that she would fall in love with death. The rule was that when you're stuck with one of these arrows, you fall in love with the first person you see after that. And Aphrodite had arranged for death to stop by. But young adolescent Eros was so taken by her beauty that he got all fumbly and all thumbs and stuck himself with one of his arrows and fell in love with her immediately. Then he has her transported to a paradise to be just with him. This is how you know Eros is an adolescent. That's the adolescent's paradise. Transporting the mythic love to a paradise to be with you alone. Eros had strict rules. All paradises have strict rules. Makes you glad there's a way out of them. Eros's rules were that he would join her at night, but she could never see him. She could never ask him questions, and she could never know him. If she did, if she ate from the tree of knowledge, to mix myths up here, the paradise would end, he said. Still, it seemed like paradise, so she stayed, spending the nights with him, waking to find him gone before the sunlight could show her his face. Now, luckily, all paradises have a serpent in them, or we would never get out of these fools' paradises and have a chance to grow up. And the serpent in this paradise is played by her sisters, who seem nasty and jealous, but are also the voices inside of her that are trying to sober her up. They keep asking how she's doing, and she tells him, "I'm with a wonderful man I don't know." This isn't just an ancient story. See how high-pitched all the laughter is? The sisters told her he was probably an ugly monster. And they talked her into taking two tools with her that night, a light, an oil lantern, and a sharp knife. And they said what she needed to do was, after he's asleep, light the light so that she can see his face, and when she realizes what a horrible, ugly monster he is, probably has a serpent head or something, then she can stab him with a knife before he wakes up and destroys her. So she did. But what the light showed her was the face of a young god. Startled, she dropped the knife, and a drop of hot oil spilled on his shoulder, and he woke up and saw that she disobeyed, and he left her, just like that. Paradise was over. What the Greeks are saying was that women have these two tools, an ability to illuminate things and a sharp knife. And a lot depends on which one they use and when, though they'll need them both at different times. Even today, people talk about cutting remarks a woman can make or how she can cut him down. Just a well-aimed, sharp comment that really scored a bullseye can do it. And it can do so much damage, it's hard ever to undo. It's dangerous using the knife first. The light meant that the Greeks thought women could usually see more deeply into men than men could see. And a lot of that seems true. In relationships today, it's almost always the woman who says, "We need to talk." Who wants to explore what he feels, what he thinks, who he is at a deeper, more personal level. Who wants to shine the light on his face and see who it is she's with. But in the story, this also meant that she threatened to know him, and that can't work in adolescent paradises, so he left. The paradise was over as quick as a Hollywood marriage. And the end of paradise is really the beginning of young Psyche's chance to grow up if she can do it. And the way the Greeks wrote their story, they're not altogether sure that she can. It seems very hard. The Jungian psychologist Robert Johnson, and I've used half a dozen of his books for some of this series, sees Eros as the woman's own unconscious masculine component. It's an adolescent masculine component in girls, says, and it's the voice telling them the role to play, that pretty but vacuous role that never asks questions. The kind of girl you see in beer ads. There are a lot of psyches around here. This isn't just an old story. The kind of girls you see on the man show, which of course should be called the boy show. It's the voice in teen magazines, movies, ads, telling girls how to look and act to be attractive to young men or the adolescent parts of men of any age. Don't know or be known. Don't probe too deeply. Don't question. Be seduced by the glitter, the look, and the charisma. And be present as glitter and looks and charisma. That's adolescent love. In an adolescent paradise. Thank God it's not stable. The next steps in the story are the woman's version of Parsifal's knightly adventures and fights, his hero's quest. Her battles are inside, but they're every bit as hard. If she's to get beyond this adolescent role of Psyche and grow into a woman, she has a lot of hard work ahead of her. Aphrodite, the voice of that grown-up kind of strong femininity, lays out the tasks for her. They look like strange tasks, but the more you read them and the more you get in with them, the more you realize how down to earth they really are. First, she has to sort things out. She's overwhelmed, and she needs to sort out what does and doesn't give life to her. In the Greek myth, she had to sort through millions of seeds and put them each in their own piles, sorting out by kind of seed. And And bunches of ants helped her do this, which means the parts of her that can just focus on sorting out tasks did it. In the movie The Hours, the character of Laura is trapped in a picturesque 1950s marriage, surrounded by 100 things that are killing her, and she has to sort them out. Clean the house, cook the meals, tend to her boy, tend to her husband, keep everything looking perfect, bake and decorate the birthday cake, and when she makes a mistake in decorating the birthday cake, she has to throw it all out and start again to make the perfect birthday cake. Make this false picture convincing. Then somewhere, care for herself, attend to her own soul's needs. She had to sort out what gave death and what gave life. Some Jungian psychologists have described the feminine aspect of the soul as unfocused consciousness. It takes in too much. It's overwhelming. And Psyche's task is to learn how to sort, how to focus, so that she can attend to the things that give life. The second task is to get the strength to go through this, and they're very clear in the myth that it's a kind of masculine strength, meaning a strong strength that can do what it needs to do regardless of how this may hurt other people's feelings. In the myth, she has to get some golden fleece from a dangerous herd of rams. If she does it in the daytime, if she takes them on head on, they could hurt or kill her because she's no match for their physical strength. But her wiser voices tell her, go over there at night, pick some from the bushes where it rubbed off. Don't confront, just take the strength you need. Both modern psychologists and ancient mythmakers are saying it takes a tough-minded kind of strength here. Not a lot of it, but a little of it. And it's safest for a woman to steal some masculine energy rather than try to take it in a head-on fight. I've heard so many stories of women who tried to take on the rams directly. I remember a woman telling me about the time she confronted her father over his habit of demeaning her. And she was just withered by his anger and his insulting outbursts. And that had happened 35 years before she told me the story. Or battered women who try to have a showdown, challenging their battering partner's masculinity and authority with brutal, sometimes deadly results. It's safer and wiser just quietly to gather the strength you need to do what you need to do. Don't waste energy on unnecessary risks. Psyche's third task is like the first, to take just a little bit of life and develop it rather than being overwhelmed by the whole flood of it. In the myth, she has to go to the river Styx, the river of life and death, huge rushing river. She has to fill just one tiny crystal goblet with water, no more, just that much, just as much as she can handle. Don't be overwhelmed. It's about sorting things out. In the movie The Hours, this led to one of the most amazing scenes I've ever seen in a motion picture. The floodwaters of the river Styx are pictured graphically, almost shockingly. It's an amazing scene. Laura is lying on a hotel bed contemplating suicide. You view the whole scene from above, and suddenly, and I mean this happens in less than 3 seconds, the entire room is flooded with water from below. It must have been 1,000 gallons a second coming up. It's simply flooded with water from below that rises, covers the bed, and covers her that quick. I've never seen a psychological mood given such a graphic staging. And it seems like that that make you see how profound these old myths are and what they saw and what they're saying. All the tasks of keeping the house, baking the cake, keeping the picture pretty, and absorbing all the unhealth and all the unhappiness in the family were the flood that was killing the character of Laura in the movie. Just take a goblet full. You can't handle the whole flood. Take a goblet full and choose only the parts you can handle, the parts that give you life. In the movie, she made a radical and a surprising, to me, a shocking choice. After the birth of her second child, she simply abandoned her family. She left the children and her husband and fled to Toronto, where she became a librarian. That was all the flood of life she could handle. The costs of this sorting and choosing and leaving are really high. In the movie, her role was to carry all the unhappiness and unhealth and death of a very sick system. When she left, the unhappiness and death had to go somewhere. 50 years later, when she appeared again in the movie as an old woman after the suicide of her son, she said that the whole scene in the 1950s in Los Angeles had been death to her, and she chose life. Both her husband and her daughter died of cancer. The sickness and the death had to go somewhere. In her life, both staying and leaving had terrible costs. It's not that her choices are recommended for others. It's just that they were the only way she could find out of it. She had used that second tool, the knife, to cut herself free from what was to her a death trap. Most women would have chosen differently. Most women would have chosen children and family over a solitary life as a librarian in another country. She was almost a negative example, one that ran counter to type. At least it ran counter to stereotype. Part of the story in both the myth and the movie is that the tender mercies, the feminine kind of caring that are so often a sign of a mature woman's depth of love, can be traps to keep her from making the hard decisions she needs to make to cut off parts of her life that are death to her. That's the masculine energy, the golden fleece. It only takes a little, but without a little of that kind of strength, it can't be done. The fourth and final task is implied in all of this, though it's the most difficult. It's the inner visit to your own unconscious, your own soul, the place where you can discern your own soul's calling, your own unique style, who you are, who you need to become, how you must live, what you must do to become centered in your soul rather than responding to the demands around you. Now you see, this is the exact opposite of the story of Psyche at the beginning. At the beginning, she had no center that told her what to do. Her whole life was choreographed for her by others, and she just responded to it. Now she's done the work of sorting out what mattered and bringing it to bloom. She's worked for and gained her own soul and her own life. It took a toll, and in the old myth, it is Eros, who's also grown up in the meantime, who finally reclaims her and completes her. This Eros is several things. It really is a complex myth. It's a wonderful myth. First, it's the adolescent Eros, now grown up. But since we know that Eros never grows up, it means that this is really her own interior, masculine and strong side that's come to complement her mature feminine self. It's sensitivity and tenderness and power all combined in the service of her soul. That's salvation. Eros is also love, for this is still the story of the soul's search for love. And only love can finally unite all the parts of our psyche into an authentic whole. Now Zeus, the head god in the Greek mythology, Zeus sees all this and he decrees that the story is about over and that Psyche and Eros now should be married. And so the wedding takes place and Psyche is given a drink that gives her immortality so that she can join the gods. That's so lovely it hardly needs translating. That the growth of a woman from an adolescent psyche to a mature and integrated woman is a sacred event blessed by all the gods. And she bore a child, the old myth says, a daughter whose name was Pleasure. It's a funny touch. She became one with the gods. She found the integration of her soul through the work of sorting, focusing, choosing that which gave her life. And when she was done, she found her grown-up self in a holy union with love forever. Whether it's in an old Greek myth, a modern movie, or a real down-to-earth woman's life, it sounds like calling the results of all that pleasure is a great, magnificent example of complete understatement.